This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Rattling Bones and Poltergeists, the good, the bad, and the ugly of ghost stories.
So first of all, I want to say a warm welcome back to Jules. You guys won't realise this because we obviously had episodes continue going on, but Jules has been away for the last week.
Yes, I have been over in Japan, Tokyo to Kyoto and various places in between. So if I stop making sense, I mean, you know, even less sense than usual, that's part of it because I landed yesterday.
You must be very tired. Did you have a good time?
I had a brilliant time. It was excellent.
Did you encounter any good myths, legends or anything like that while you were out there?
Yeah, most of them were to do with the temples and things like that. And I'd have to remind myself what some of the temples are called. But there's a really, really big Shinto temple outside of Kyoto. There's no nails holding this 18-foot platform up. It's all sort of wood carefully stacked and shaped to fit. And they call it the wishing performance platform. And basically people jump off the platform, presumably to their deaths, in order to get their wish, which seems a bit counterproductive. But apparently...
Unless their wish was to jump off the platform.
Well, yeah, I mean, unless that was the end result, in which case there's a pretty good chance they're going to get it. But there was one case back in the 17th century where 438 people jumped at the same time, and apparently 80% of them survived.
Did they get their wish?
I don't know. There's no documentation on that bit.
Maybe they did, but no one wanted to advertise it, otherwise more people would end up jumping.
This is on the side of a mountain, so you know, you'd kind of expect to die at that point. It's pretty high up.
Well, it might very well be that as they're falling, they lose track of their wish and just go, I wouldn't have to die. I hope I don't die. And then they survive, and so technically their wish is granted.
Yeah. And then there's all the sorts of, I mean, there's shrines everywhere, absolutely, Buddhist and Shinto and Zen shrines for various different things, and you can just make offerings or go through various other, you know, there's the hand washing and washing out your mouth purification type thing.
Yeah.
So I went along and did some of that. That was interesting. And I felt sort of compelled by a guide who was with us one day to actually, he said, oh, you must pray at this Buddhist shrine. I'm thinking, I'm not actually a Buddhist. I mean, yeah.
Well, actually, that's the thing, because this has nothing to do with books or anything, but actually most Japanese people are atheist, because what, they have like Shinto weddings, Buddhist funerals, or is it the other way around?
Yeah, well, no, they have a traditional Shinto or Buddhist wedding usually with the costume, which is very similar, and then after the traditional wedding they go home and change into a Western white dress that we would, well, in theory we'd wear if we were getting married in a church over here.
They've sort of merged the two, but actually most, it's more of a cultural thing rather than a religious thing.
But there was an awful lot of people still going along and praying as well. Anyway, I didn't have a problem with it because I'm a pagan, and the benefit of being a pagan is the fact that your gods don't tend to get peed off if you call them by other names. So
it was. What's she calling me today? That's fine.
Oh, it's her again. Look, just put her on hold.
I'm too busy frolicking. That's what pagan gods do. They frolic. I'm reliably informed. Anyway today's episode is all about ghosts and ghost stories. Now, I love a good ghost story. Don't know about you.
I love a good ghost story. My problem is that most of them aren't very effective for me, and I'm not entirely sure why. It's not a case of I want to be absolutely terrified, but I want to be properly scared, as in I want something to disturb my sense of status quo, which I think is what a good ghost story does. And gross-out horror doesn't affect me at all, because I tend to sit there going, that's not realistic, that wouldn't happen. I don't know if that's working so many years in the NHS that I think, no, that just wouldn't happen.
Quite desensitised.
Yeah, it's like blood and guts and hands and fingers and things coming off. It's like, no, that's fine. You'd upset me more if you sat there and strategically broke somebody's fingers than, you know, if you sprayed the walls with blood. But that's just me.
No, I think I'm with you on that one. And I think actually a real disappointment, and this is the Jaws thing, which is the ghost stories tend to set themselves up. And then at the last minute you see the ghost and you're kind of, you know what I mean? So they build themselves up and then they don't deliver.
I mean, my theory is there are three things you need for a really good ghost story. And one is the fact that there's always something just out of the corner of your eye. It should give you this quiet sense of disturbance. So it's not like a slasher film. It's not like normal horror. There's always this slight feeling of unease. There should be some kind of almost logic to it. There should be something almost out of reach. So it's a bit otherworldly, but it's something you could almost understand. It's not like the Fair Folk, where they have their own set of rules and they understand things differently because the intelligence is alien. This is the sort of intelligence where, you know, something is following a logical path. We just don't have the facility to understand it, but we're quite close. So there's that sense of crossing over. Yeah. And the third thing, and it's the thing I think that most ghost stories seem to get wrong, is it should never, ever be completely resolved at the end. There should always be a slight question mark. A what if it had gone a bit differently? A what if, you know, this hasn't actually been solved kind of thing. There is always some, you know, where have they really gone?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that, well, when I think about ghost stories, and, you know, I tend to prefer hearing about sort of local myths and stuff like that. And I actually tend to prefer hearing about local folk story ghost stories because there is that element of the unresolved, because they're real life stories. So you don't get the end of the book, if that makes sense. There's no real plot to it. It's an experience that happened, and then there's no real explanation. You just have to sort of, and that gives me an uneasy feeling, which I quite enjoy in that sense. But I think, now, I wonder whether we're going to come to some disagreement here, because I'm a big fan of The Woman in Black, but I should point out here that I'm not actually talking about the book, and I'm not talking about the film, which I think was just a little bit over the top. I saw some of the trailers for it. They had moving dolls and whatnot, and I just thought that's just a little bit excessive.
They did, and I thought, I mean, I enjoyed the film for what it was, which was, you know, a visual spectacular moving wallpaper kind of thing. It wasn't scary.
I presume that Daniel Radcliffe was actually quite good at it.
Yeah, he was good. To be honest, I don't think you'd have necessarily put him in that part as, you know, a young father who'd lost his wife at that stage in his career. But, you know, that's casting decision.
But see, that's the thing, because, again, I haven't read the book, and I haven't really seen the movie, but I have studied extensively the play. I went to see it when I was probably a little bit too young to go see it. Definitely a little bit too young. And I thought, I'm not going to be scared at all because ghosts didn't scare me. Because I thought they can't really hurt me because they can't touch stuff. And it terrified me. I was so frightened. And the first half was relatively boring. And then it picked up at the end of the first half. And it was like, oh, cool. And then the second half was just, my heart wouldn't stop racing. It was terrifying. And the way it ends is just, it's the perfect example in my mind of how ghost stories should end. Because it ended with this absolute question mark, which made you go, oh my God.
Yeah.
And now you can leave and go back to your normal lives, never truly knowing.
Never sleeping again. Yeah. Which is what it should do. And The Woman in Black is a good one. And to be fair, Susan Hill is the acknowledged master of creating atmosphere and building it slowly so that you've got this mounting sense of tension.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about music, and I certainly don't know a lot about writing music. But if you're trying to create a certain emotion in your listener, then you would gradually pick up through the scales or add a new note in, a new instrument if it's an ensemble piece, something like that.
Yeah.
So it's very much the same thing if you're writing a ghost story, in my opinion.
Yep, I agree. And I think it's funny because actually for those who don't know about the Woman in Black, it's the story of this haunting, and anyone who sees this woman shortly after seeing her, a child will die, and that's just the way it is. And my mother went to see it for the first time when she was pregnant with my brother. And they were like, "You sure you want to see this?" She's like, "It'll be fine." And then she walked out and she was there like, "I shouldn't have gone to see that." Terrifying.
Early labour.
Because of course, and it's a very unnerving play. And you know it's unnerving because, as I said, I've studied it, I've seen it, and I've been in it a couple of times as well. And one time I was actually the woman in it. And even as the woman, I scared, like, I was the ghost and I was terrified of myself because the atmosphere, the build up, the sound effects as well, the sound effects are really what get me because it's not gory, but I never understood the meaning of the word blood curdling scream until I went to see that play. And after that, I've never been able to forget the feeling it gave me. And it went from being like literally heart-pumpingly terrifying to this real unease. And there are certain sounds which you started to associate. And it's as you said, there was an element of something in the corner of your eye. And I think I remember I went to see it with a bunch of schoolmates after I'd seen it, and they were all like, "Ah, we're gonna fall asleep, and it's gonna be really boring." And I'm like, "Trust me, if you fall asleep, you will not stay asleep for long, because there's gonna be screams and all sorts." And they were terrified by the end, but I just remember one moment distinctly, which is at one point the lady actually came out among the audience, and she came from the back and she just glided through, which meant that you were watching the stage and then from the like 1 second something would move in your peripheral and she would be gliding past you.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying, but the boy on the aisle had his leg sticking out, and as she passed him, she pushed his leg back into his seat. It took him a while to recover. He was so scared. So yeah, the epitome of ghost story, therefore, for me, is the play. And I think actually plays can almost succeed where some books can't, and can almost succeed where movies can't, because actually I think movies are impeded by the fact that they have more opportunity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, they're impeded by the fact that they are almost entirely visual media. I mean, obviously you have the audio and you have the music and things like that, but with the book, it's you're leaving a lot of it to the reader's imagination.
Yeah,
with theatre, it's a wonderful happy medium between the two, because you're supplying enough, but the audience, you know, a really successful play means that the audience, whether they realize it or not, is participating in that play, even if they do nothing.
But I think also the kind of people who go to see theater tend to be open-minded to that, you know, tend to have the mind which can sort of access the best parts of that type of media. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, and I think ghost stories, and I think the reason that we tell ghost stories and we enjoy it is that there is an element of ghost stories are best when they're told in person, when there's a human element to it, where you can build an atmosphere in your surroundings, when you can create the story, if that makes sense, rather than just see it or just read it to hear it. Ghost stories are best told, I feel.
Yeah, and I think that taps directly into the psychology of learning via story. And we are hardwired to learn through story. You know, going back to early hunter-gatherers, it would have been a learning tale. It would have been a case of, wow, I almost got taken out by this leopard or this tiger or whatever. But the rustling in the grass, there may be something there, there may not be something there. But yeah, it's on an evolutionary level, it's actually to our benefit, or has been to our benefit, to believe that the rustling of the grass isn't actually just the wind, that there might be a predator there, because you've lost nothing if you run away and there's nothing there. But yeah, if you don't run away and something is there, then, well, you wouldn't have survived to procreate and,
yeah,
you know,
exactly,
produce,
yeah,
the rest of the human race anyway. So
scientific reason for why ghost stories are so effective.
You know, it started off as a learning experience, and there's this sort of biological necessity to sort of people the world with half-seen sort of chimerical beings in that respect. At least that's my theory.
I think it's a sound theory.
Yeah,
it's
when that goes overboard that it becomes an issue, I think.
Yeah. Now, I think another really effective thing that works for me with ghost stories is unrelenting stories where no matter what a person does, really, they can't actually stop the ghost, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, The Ring, I have mixed feelings about The Ring as a movie. The first one I actually think was, even though it was obviously translated into a Western way, and it was a little bit ridiculous, like the whole 7 days down the phone thing is just a bit ridiculous, but obviously they needed to spell it out for people.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent. It's just that I watched The Ring and then that evening my sister phoned me. So as I answered the phone, I knew it was her. And I said, "You will die in 7 days." And she went really quiet and then started laughing. Obviously called me names, which I can't repeat.
Well, I always think that the film would have been rather ruined if people actually had, you know, proper ringtones that they have now. You know, diddle-a-da, diddle-a-da, diddle-a-da-da.
You're going to die in 7 days. I'm like, really?
Well, it'd be really ineffective if someone called me. I've got Coldplay as my...
Something really emo and depressing, like, I don't know, My Chemical Romance or something. It's kind of like, oh, thank God.
I think the ghost just wouldn't call anyone if she knew that their ringtone was going to be something, you know, like, you're going to die in 7 days. You know, it just wouldn't have been quite as effective.
What if you know, fortunately, text message?
Yeah. Be even funnier because my text message alert is the Monty Python message for you, sir.
That's even better.
So, imagine if she added emojis as well at the end, you know, 7 days, smiley face. But anyway, so fortunately in the movie, they all had very serious ringtones. But in the Japanese, the original Japanese one, there was just silence over the phone, which was kind of scarier because silence, again, plays on that human ability, which is you've heard something odd and then you can't hear anything else to corroborate, basically, your suspitions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you can't go, oh, it's just the wind, I can see. There's no further evidence, so your mind is left wandering. So they added the 7 days. But anyway, the Western version, I still think, was quite good. And I think actually one of the best, he was a very good example of a good ghost story, because they went through this whole thing, and then in the end, it didn't actually matter. Like, it didn't matter that she saved they found the body. It didn't matter that she discovered all these things. Because at the end of the day, the ghost wasn't stopping. She wouldn't stop. She stopped for this person because that person followed her rules. But there was no breaking the pattern, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And now, speaking of patterns, I feel it's also worth mentioning, obviously, your book, Jules, because you do have a ghost story as well. Now, I don't want to ruin the ending, but even though there is a sort of resolve at the end of yours, there is also an element of, but it's not, there's still something going on. They're still out there. The ghosts don't necessarily, you know, ghosts don't just disappear because she's like, well, you know what I mean? Try not to ruin anything.
No. Well, I'm always really interested to hear what people think happened to the two particular, well, in fact, the three particular ghosts, without giving them names, that caused so much trouble in that particular book. And we're essentially trying to live out this sort of twisted love story again through, you know, yet another generation of young people. So I'm always really interested to hear what people think happened, because I don't actually say in so many words what really happens to them.
No, you don't.
So it's kind of make your mind up, and I think it's a good way to do it. I'm not even sure that I am 100% sure what happens. I have a theory, but I don't know for sure. So there you go.
Good way to do it. So go on then. All right, let's hear some of your bugbears, Jules, because I know you're anxious to sort of get some of them out.
Right, bugbears, really. I'm just going to talk about Susan Hill again, who's given us a really, really great example in The Woman in Black, which is, you know, pretty moderately chilling book, although I felt the ending fell a bit flat in the book. It fell even flatter in the film, and I haven't seen the stage production, but I'd quite like to now. Because I do sit there with ghost stories thinking, please, please scare me. Do it properly. But so very few of them actually do. Yeah, she's written quite a lot of other ghost stories, and she's got a series of small novellas like Small Hand, Printer's Devil Court, and Dolly. Now, Dolly, I had genuine high hopes for, because China dolls are freaky as anything.
Yep.
My sister, my youngest sister, collected China dolls since she was a small child. This is just an aside, just to tell you. You're going to think my family's really weird, but I'm going to tell you anyway. She collected them since she was a small child. My gran used to buy them for her, and there was a whole cabinet of them.
And oh, God, oh, God. We're going to get them all. We're going to put them in a cabinet.
Yes, they always used to look
so
out.
So that when one person looks in a cabinet, they'll see one missing, you know?
Exactly. They looked out through the glass doors with their glassy, staring eyes that seemed to follow you. I used to stay over at my mum and dad's after they'd moved house. There were occasions where I had to sleep in the dining room on a camp bed because there just wasn't enough space, because I'd left home. And I'd be lying there in the dark and the China dolls would be staring out through the doors at me. Anyway, Ella invited me to stay at her and her husband's place. And I said, hang on a minute, have you put the China dolls out? Sort of jokingly. And she said, yeah, but that's fine, they won't be in your room. I said, oh, that's good. She said, you will hear them at night because it's a wooden floor and they sort of drag themselves along by their hands and scritch over the floorboards.
Oh, come on.
And I'm like, you cow! Why did you tell me that? I mean, obviously I didn't get an influx of China dolls during the night or anything. It's like, mind you, this is the sister who has got this really freaky cardboard Mr. Bean mask and will put it on when you're not expecting it, and when you turn round and you've just got these blank eye holes of Mr. Bean staring at you.
I'm starting to understand all your influences, Jules.
Yeah. And she's the one who finds I Belong to the Earth really, really scary and can't seem to get very far with it. So anyway, moving on from that. Going back to Susan Hill. Yeah, Dolly. And it started off really well in the sense of, you know, there were two children and one of them was quite a naive, but a nice, decent boy who grows up to be quite a decent man. And the other one's quite a spoilt girl who's a bit precocious. And the one thing she always wanted was a China doll dressed in this particular Indian princess sort of way. And then years and years later, having been thrown together for a couple of summers at an old house, because, you know, that's practically a prerequisite for a ghost story, when they've both grown up and the girl's on something like her fourth husband and is in the process of leaving him as well, he finds out that the house and everything has been left to him. And the woman is absolutely furious about this, and he's sort of saying, well, you know, you're leaving your husband, it's okay if you want to just stay in the house for the time being, I'll leave the key with so and so. And as a sort of present, he goes to buy this China doll he finds dressed exactly how she wanted it as a girl, as a sort of comfort peace type offering. Yeah. And then children start disappearing and there's loads of other freaky stuff, and then it completely falls flat on its face at the end.
Oh, that's a shame.
Because having built all this up really, really cleverly and really carefully, suddenly it's like the curtains pulled up and you can see that the set's made of jigsawed
pulleys and
chipboards and pulleys, and you can see the smoke machine. It feels very much like that. And it's the same with the other two, with Small Hand, where, again, it's an old house and the main character keeps feeling a small child's hand being slipped into their own, which is quite creepy.
Yes.
Except, again, it falls flat on its face at the end. And it does the same with Printer's Devil Court, where it's kind of a bit Frankenstein-esque in the sense of they're trying to remove the soul from a body and put it into another body, and this man who didn't want anything to do with it sort of leaves his friends to it because they're all studying in, you know, sort of late Victorian medical school. And this one particular woman follows him around for the rest of his life. You know, he keeps coming across her. And when he does speak to her, she speaks with the voice of an old man who's had his, you know, soul scooped out of one body and put in hers. And he tries to fix it. And again, it just falls completely flat. It's got so much promise, all of these ones have. And it's kind of like, it almost feels like the author gets to the end and thinks, well, I don't know what to do now. I'm just going to end the book.
That's a shame.
I wouldn't say they're completely resolved at the end. There is still a question mark, but the point is, by the time you get to the question mark, the tension's been sort of diffused, and you don't care. You don't care about the answer to the question, I think.
Again, I haven't read a lot of her, so I couldn't, I can't give my opinion on that, but I get a feeling for what you're trying to say. And that is a real shame, because the setup is almost the hardest thing to do. Well, no, that's a lie actually. They're both fairly equal, but you want to give something at the end. You can't just set it up and then let it sort of just slowly sort of deflate.
I mean, it's possible that
Like a
perhaps,
wayward balloon.
yeah, well, maybe my expectations are too high. Maybe I was expecting something that would scare me personally more, and other people would have found it more chilling. I mean, that's possible as well.
Yeah.
But it's things like, I don't know if you read any M.R. James.
No, I haven't actually.
Very famous for ghost stories. And what he does is not so much ghosts, he does really good entities. And you never really get an explanation of what's happened. But I don't find any of them scary. And the most famous one, Oh Whistle and I'll Come to Thee. I'll Come to You. Oh Whistle and I'll Come to You. A man finds a tin whistle in a church where he's visiting, and on the side of it in Latin is written, "Who is this? Who is coming?" And being, because he finds a
An
tin whistle, he blows the whistle. And
idiot.
then this entity just starts appearing to him. But it appears to him under the bedclothes, in the spare bed next to his, in the inn he's staying in, and things like that. And it's all described as a face of crumpled linen. And it's just a case of, I can see how this would have been really chilling at the time, but this is coming across as quite dated now.
Yeah.
You can see that it's a really good entity. It's not just a ghost. There's no purpose that you can fathom. You think there's a purpose, but it's not explained to you. And the other one to talk about, obviously, is Edgar Allan Poe, who was clearly a bit peculiar in the best possible sense of the word.
Just a tad.
But again, I can't say I found any of them really particularly scary.
Well, I don't think they were really meant to be. Well, I don't know. I guess maybe they were meant to be scary, but I felt more like they were just meant to sort of make you uneasy, if that makes sense.
Well, I say
Because he was
scary,
quite
I mean uneasy.
yeah. And I mean, he was quite gory, Edgar Allan Poe. The goriness of things, I think, usually makes most. I mean, you're odd. You realise that, of course.
Thank you.
But, I think, yeah, most people don't really like that kind of horror, and they weren't used to it in the time either, as well. We do have to consider the era that they were written in.
I always felt with Edgar Allan Poe as though he sort of grabbed hold of the human soul and shook out the creases to try and get all the dark crumbs that had accumulated out and make people look at them. And which is great, but if I don't know if you've ever read The Telltale Heart.
No, I haven't.
The concept's really good, but I have to say when I reread it again, I felt a bit sort of disappointed. I mean, I read it at 10 when I was 10 and thought, wow, this is brilliant. And then read it again fairly recently and thought, meh. Not because there's anything wrong with the concept. The concept's really good, and the fact is that this man just loses it and kills the person he's caring for, and then he's really quite blasé about it. The reason he kills him is because he doesn't like the old man's eye.
Oh wait. Yes, no, it's starting to ring a bell. It's listed, so I've got it listed in my brain under another bunch of other short stories, including The Yellow Wallpaper. That was one that got under my skin. Mostly because at the end you're like, what happened? There's no explanation. It ends and you're like, I don't understand. It stop.
Then you think things like the more gory ones, like Masquerade of the Red Death, and it's
Yeah.
kind of like, well, everybody in the kingdom is dying, so I'm going to shut up my palace and have a big party, but at the end, the only victor is death. the only person who ever wins anything. And this guy's like, okay, but what are you trying to say? His poetry, in some ways, is a little bit more, I think, is a little bit creepier. Like, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a particular one where there's a sort of fairy-esque type woman, and it's not, she's not really. But this man, throughout the poem, well, it's more of a letter, actually. You can see him losing more and more of himself as he goes on, talking about how wondrously fair she is, etc. And it's almost like he's describing some sort of succubus-type creature. You can tell she's not a woman at all. And you also think he's a bit of an idiot for falling for it. and the raven. There's something very sad about the raven.
Again, I'm not a big reader of Edgar Allan Poe. But, you know, see, this is the thing. I really, really do. I love ghost stories, but I don't tend to read them because I'm actually really easily scared. So for my own self-preservation, I tend not to read them. Because otherwise, that's me. That's me done for like...
That's you. It's all over.
It's me. I'm just like, well, I was hoping to sleep tonight, but I was hoping to sleep in the next year, but no, I guess not. Now, here's a question, moving on, because this does need to be asked. We've got our two famous ones in my mind and that I need to ask you your opinion on, and that is The Blair Witch Project and The Sixth Sense.
Okay, the Blair Witch Project. I actually went and saw this at the cinema when it came out.
Oh, God.
I thought you'd find that funny. That's how old I am. I was at university when that came out. And we went at Halloween and watched that at the cinema. And I was so bored. It was the first time someone had ever done anything really with found footage type film. And we got to the end and I'm like, that was it. That was it. Seriously? What? And it's like, it's not creepy, you're in a wood, you can navigate, it's not that bad. Anyway, sorry, I had difficulty finding a parallel in myself with the fear of the characters, which was gradually growing to terror and mania, and I wasn't going with them, I wasn't following a journey with them, so I didn't like it. A lot of people did, and a lot of people thought it was a really clever, classy, well done film. And I just didn't, I'm afraid.
That's fair enough. Again, it's not one I've seen. I just have heard a lot about it, but I thought I'd give it a miss because actually I think that it's the kind of thing that I might be frightened by because it's quite circumstantial, I guess, in some ways. I don't know. I also live in the middle of a forest, so...
Yeah, I mean, you never see anything, really. All you ever see is them giving their accounts of how frightened they are and, you know, something moves the tent but you don't see what it is, and the fact that they panic and they run, which is the most stupid thing you can do if something's coming after you and you don't know what it is and you're already lost. This was part of my problem, the complete lack of common sense.
I think, yeah, that is something that happens in... But it's an odd thing because I always think, you know, you watch... scary movies, you watch ghost stories and stuff like that, and there's a weird noise and you're sitting there going, no, don't go towards it, leave the house, and you're thinking, if I was there I just wouldn't be going anywhere towards it. And then like I, you know, that there's me thinking that, and then sort of the next day I heard a weird noise in my flat and I'm like, better go and investigate, and as I was walking toward it I'm like, hold on a second. If there was an audience member, they'd be berating me right now. But I guess it's because, you know, we talk about, you know, if I heard a creepy noise, I'd run away from it. Except, no, you wouldn't, because people don't actually really have a real belief in ghosts. So if they hear something that creepy, they tend to go, there's a logical explanation and I need to go and find that logical explanation, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, if you went into a house and someone said, yeah, three people have died, then you'd probably run away.
I mean, I've got perfect example of this. I was house sitting years ago, even longer ago than the Blair Witch Project, I'll just say. I was house sitting when I was 17, and I was by myself in this in a friend's house, and I was there by myself for a week, and I was studying for my A levels at the time as well. And I was having a bit of a break, and I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll watch Poltergeist 2 because I've never seen it by myself.
It's a good idea.
Because I'm just not bothered by these sort of films at all. Except the character of Kane is kind of creepy in that. Anyway, got to the bit where Kane is persuading all the people to go underground with him, you know, like a proper preacher type thing where it's a case of everybody drink the Kool-Aid and they're all going to get sealed in. You can tell they're all going to die. So it's a fairly tense moment. And then I heard shuffle, 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 shuffle. And I thought, what's that? Oh, it's nothing. Turn the film back on again. Rattle, rattle, shuffle, shuffle. And I turned it off again. I was like, okay, I definitely heard something that time. And I waited for a few minutes thinking, I'm not freaked out, but I'm alert now. I'm just really, really alert.
Yeah.
And there was nothing. Turn the film back on. Shuffle, shuffle, shuffle. And soot fell down the chimney. And I was like, okay, that could have just been happening anyway. Turn the film on again. It got to the part where something's literally about to jump out at you. And you could tell it was going to happen because the music's doing that something bad is happening, something bad is happening, something bad is happening to you type feeling. And something shot out of the chimney straight towards my face, trailing soot behind it and squawking. And I didn't scream because I'd forgotten how to breathe. And I put my hands up and caught it because it was falling by this point, and it was a starling that had fallen down the chimney.
Oh.
So, yeah, that was a special experience. Anyway, I released the starling and went back in and finished the film, but
you're a braver woman than I am.
I have to know how things finish.
I just Wikipedia it.
I hate not. This is why whenever I do a book review, if I write DNF, I'm really, really annoyed because I hate the fact that I haven't been able to finish the book. yeah, but as you say, we all think we're not going to go and investigate the strange noise, but you will. Because that's that same thing, the same
the
sort of
logical thing to do,
something really. Moving the grass. Is it a threat or is it just the wind? There's that same instinct that has kept us alive and able to evolve like this. So it seems stupid, but it is something that would happen. And I think I made a reference to this in a short story I wrote that was in between I Belong to the Earth and I Am the Silence, which is book two, which is where Grace and Emmeline are house sitting. And they hear a knocking outside, and Emmeline wants to go charging out, and Grace grabs her and said, "Or instead of doing what all the stupid girls do in serial killer films and charge straight out there and get their heads locked off, we could arm ourselves and bar ourselves into the kitchen." So I was poking a bit of fun at that. But
I've actually done something similar in the Kestrel saga, and it's not really ghosts in that book, but what happens is that. One of the Kestrel goes into this house and she sort of goes to open the door and it creaks open and she can feel something's wrong. And so the first thing she does is she presses her back against the wall, looks up at the ceiling, looks around at all corners and literally edges. She doesn't walk down the corridor, she edges along the wall so that nothing can come at her from behind.
Well, that's actually quite sensible.
Yeah, and it's the first thing she does. She literally, whenever she goes into things, she just keeps her back against the wall so that she can see pretty much everything at the same time without having to worry about something coming up behind her. And she's there like, no, nope, I'm not doing this. I've seen these movies. So, yeah.
Because it's always, always behind you. It doesn't matter which way you're facing, it's always behind you.
Yeah, you always turn and then you look back and there it is. So, yeah, luckily women have got a slightly wider peripheral, so she was using it. Now, so this is the question then. The Sixth Sense.
I really like that film. That's one of the few. Generally, with mysteries, I either know within the first few pages, or in this case, the first few bit, you know, the first sort of 10 minutes of the film, what the big twist is or who did it, or I don't know anything until the very end. And this is one of those few unusual ones where I really genuinely did not see the twist coming until it happened, and I was in the cinema going, oh my god. Genuinely did not see that coming. Fight Club, saw that coming a mile off, but thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
Sixth Sense, no, didn't realise right up until the part where the ring rolled across the floor, and I was like, no, it can't be. And I thought it was really, really good. But it wasn't a ghost story in the It was a ghost story because it was about ghosts, but it wasn't a ghost story in the sense of it was trying to leave you with a sense of unease. It was almost trying to leave you with a sense of peace, as if it stirred up those feelings of discomfort in the first place, and then sort of laid them to rest to say, well, you know what, perhaps what they really want is help, and perhaps what they really need is some understanding. And the fact that they don't operate on the same levels and laws of physics as you do anymore doesn't actually mean there's something very badly wrong. So, it was so sad.
I remember just that one scene where the little girl comes to him, and she unpegs the tent and stuff like that, and he sort of pulls it off, and, you know, she's vomiting and stuff like that, and he's going, oh, and he runs off, and then he comes back, he's there like, can I help you?
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And I just thought, you know what you could have done? You could have not had such a creepy entrance. Maybe that... like, I understand you want to help, but, like, if you want somebody to help you, you don't try and scare the living wits out of them first.
Okay. And that brings me brilliantly onto another film, which is a really good film, but in my opinion, not a good ghost story, which is Crimson Peak.
Crimson Peak.
I loved it. It's visually spectacular. It's funny. The characters were quite endearing. There's something a bit eerie about the whole thing, but at the same time, it's like her mother's ghost turns up to warn her when she's about 10 years old, and her mother's ghost does it by turning up, looking all decayed, floating above her bed and screaming in her face. And I'm like, is that seriously the best method of communication?
Just send a text. Ask the woman from The Ring. She knows how to operate phones. Like, just...
It's like spirit communications.
Yeah. I need to tell them an important message, so I'm going to do it in the most uncommunicative way possible.
Absolutely love that film. Saw most of the twists coming a mile off, but didn't care because I was just enjoying it. It was visually spectacular. And I'm sorry, if you go to a house that's called Crimson Peak and there's all this blood-coloured mud clay bubbling out of the ground, and you're kind of like, you should know what you're letting yourself in for. In my opinion.
For real. Anyway, so...
okay, I'm going to move on to a book that I've mentioned before on several other occasions, but I'll go into it a little bit more. So I might spoilify people. So if you haven't read the book and you want to, and you don't want to know what's going to happen, then don't listen to this bit. And it is it's one of the ones that's, and it's one of like only three books that's genuinely ever really scared me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters, which I know I've mentioned before.
Yeah.
And you have to get about a quarter of the way into the book, really, before you really start to see things start to happen. It is a very slow build tension-wise, but you need that because you need the build-up of exactly where the main character, the doctor's mindset, is at, and exactly what is happening. And there are things that are never explained in that book. The writing on the wall, like, you know, childish writing that just won't wash away, won't be scrubbed off, the way it just appears, that's never really explained. The bite marks that appear on the woman's body, you know, I think that sort of thing, it is never really explained. And the last thing, the most chilling thing, basically the doctor's come from a working class family and he's done very well to become a doctor.
Yeah.
And this is between the First and Second World Wars. So the old gentry are on the way out. The house Hundreds is a beautiful house, beautiful piece of land, but it's falling into disrepair because a lot of the gentry lost a lot of their money during the First World War and afterwards, what with the deaths of their sons and things. And he has always had this acquisitiveness, this desperation to own that house. He wants to own a piece of it. There's the daughter there who, by their standards, would have been a spinster, an old maid, and he finds her rather unattractive and plain to start with. But as he becomes more and more of a family friend, and he's a really unreliable narrator as well, which helps. He sort of inveigles himself into the family and she finally agrees to marry him. And you can tell that it's not really her he wants, it's the house. And she just wants an escape. And when she realizes that he actually wants to move into Hundreds and do it back up, basically he wants to buy his way into the gentry, even though the gentry's falling.
Yeah.
And she just wants to sell the house, get what money she can, and go and start a new life somewhere abroad,
Yeah.
possibly. Which is quite understandable, because she's had nothing but misery there at that point. There's all sorts of horrible things that happen right up to that point. And then on the night that would have been their wedding, after she breaks the engagement off, there's an account from one of the maids where she hears a noise. She goes out on the balcony. Well, they say the balcony, the landing, on the stairs. She looks up with recognition and she says, "It's you, oh my God." And then she gets thrown down over the balcony down to, if you imagine like a great hall, sort of Downton Abbey-esque, where you have the hanging galleys above where you can walk around the stairs. She gets thrown off that and dies. And it's put up as a suicide, but you're left with a big question mark. Is it? Or was it the little stranger? And what was the little stranger ultimately? Was it really this horrible, greedy, acquisitive doctor's id going out and tormenting these people out of their home effectively, and in a jealous rage sort of throwing her off the balcony? Or, since he had keys, did he let himself in and in some sort of fugue state murder her? And you're just given this clue in the last sort of couple of pages where, because he's still got a key, he never returns. Nobody manages to sell the old house. He goes and he tries to do a bit around the grounds at weekends and things, and he's passing through, like, fighting a relentless battle against the dust and the decay as the house falls apart, and he catches sight of himself in the mirror. And for one moment, he almost sets eyes on the little stranger, as it were. And then he decides it's all preposterous, because he's the one who staunchly believes that there is no ghost there all the way through, right to the end of the book. But what I found so chilling about that was the fact that, well, we all have this really dark side, this side of us that wants something a bit more. What if that dark side sort of detached itself and went out and did things without our permission? And the fact that perhaps he'd been encouraging his to do so all along, and that was genuinely really, really chilling.
That is... Whoa. Thanks. Thanks, Jules.
That's okay. You didn't want to sleep tonight, did you?
No. I was planning on ever sleeping again, actually, so there you go.
It's an absolutely awesome book. You really do have to put some effort into the first sort of quarter of the book, but it's well worth it, in my opinion. The other one that actually genuinely scared me was, well, not scared me, but left me feeling uneasy in a pleasant way, was The Splendor Falls by Rosemary Clement Moore, which is a young adult one. And there's this part, she's sent to stay with a second cousin out in the country, in America, so down south. She's a New Yorker. She doesn't really believe in ghosts, and everything in her life has sort of fallen apart before that as well. And she keeps seeing this woman in sort of Southern Belle-type costume running across the grounds late at night. She also keeps hearing a crying noise. But the bit that actually chilled me was she was in the study that belonged to the colonel who'd once owned the house. And she's there in the study looking out, and then the chair creaks behind her in the dark as if someone sat in it. And it's just that, literally just that.
Thanks. Thanks so much. I've got a lot to work with now. I appreciate that.
Okay, well, I won't mention anything else, but those are the ones that genuinely work for me. And I think it's because it hits those three notes. You've got the building tension, you've got the sense of otherworldliness that you can almost touch but not quite, and you've got the sense of there being something unresolved, big question mark at the end. Do you have a favourite ghost story?
I'm trying to think. Well, other than The Woman in Black, which, you know, as I've said, has had a very profound effect on me.
You know, did you ever hear a ghost story as a child or a teenager or whatever and thought, ooh, and that's
well, I'll tell you what, I really, really liked that whole. I don't know if you remember, a little while ago, I was living in Egypt at the time, which has also got some great ghost stories and stuff, you know, with all the tombs and whatnot, and curses. It was Hampton Court, and the video camera security footage of a door being thrown open and then a woman in a dress appearing and closing the doors. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I think I must have missed that.
It was incredible footage of what was apparently a ghost because no one was actually dressed like that. They didn't have any on. They didn't have any actors or anything like that, dressed in that fashion, or on set at that time. But I mean, you can Google it. It's very chilling imagery, and it was caught on camera. And I remember being, because I was really obsessed with the Tudors at the time, I remember just being really sort of engrossed by this footage, and it was very frightening. And you know, I've had a few ghost stories, local ones, you know, which I was told when I was little, and you know, my mother saw a ghost, and I've seen a few things in my time, you know, whether it's hair in the corner of my eye or you know, I've seen a few odd things. But I think I have a thing, and this is a little bit embarrassing, but I before when I'm just going to sleep or when I'm about to wake up, I will sometimes sleep with my eyes open. My
Oh.
eyes will open. I'll still be asleep, but my eyes will be open, and I'm kind of in an in-between state. And usually what it means is that I can actually see the room. I can see about sort of 3 meters into the room,
Yeah.
and then it kind of blurs. But I'm still asleep, so I'm also dreaming. So I can see the room, except there are other things in the room that aren't actually there. And I remember one time I went to stay with a friend of mine, and she said, "Yeah, we're in this room." She said, "You're in the haunted room." And I went, "Excuse me?" Like, first one, she said, "I'm sorry, I'm joking. It's fine." And that night, I felt very uneasy. And again, it was probably because she planted the suggestion in my head. I don't know, but there was something else, you know. I didn't feel very good, and I was just falling asleep, and I must have had my eyes open, you know, well, I thought I was still awake, but I must have been falling asleep, and something zoomed over my head like someone had thrown a book or something
Yeah.
right over my head. And of course, I'm there in the room. I could see the room. I never saw what got thrown. It might have been a bloody bat. I don't know. It could have been anything. It could have been just a very large moth. But I was terrified because I had this real sense of something wasn't right. It wasn't, you know, I'm not necessarily afraid of ghosts, but I felt this something is out of place, you know, something that shouldn't be there. Again, probably because she planted the idea in my head. Something wasn't happy for me to be there. And then I felt like someone had just tried to throw something at my head. And that was it for the rest of the night until the sun came up. I was there, I had the light on. I was there, I went, "No, I'm not going back to sleep,"
Wide
because
awake.
that was so scary. My heart racing. And so that was probably the scariest experience I've ever had. And again, it can be entirely put down to logic. I could find a bunch of explanations for it, but it doesn't matter whether I explain it or not. The fact of the matter was that at the time I was terrified. It was very scary. It was a scary experience. We can talk all, you know, as brave as we want to talk, but there's something about being in that atmosphere. And again, it goes down, you know, back to plays and stuff like that, and the whole psychology, you know, of survival. But when it comes to being in a place, and when that suggestion has been planted in your mind, it's very scary. And the human mind can do things which you wouldn't usually allow it to do.
Yeah.
It's why I don't allow Ouija boards in my house.
I think they're potentially quite dangerous anyway,
Yeah.
because even if there's nothing happening whatsoever, what you're opening yourself up to psychologically.
Yeah, that's exactly why. You know, I've often said this. People go, "What, you believe in Ouija boards?" And I said, "Look, the fact of the Ouija board is that there's a 99.99999% chance that it's just nothing, that it's not going to work. there's a tiny, 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 minuscule, absolutely tiny, you know, I never say never to anything, possibility that you're opening a door into something, to God knows where, sticking your hand in and going, hi, and hoping that, you know, nothing bad comes out, which is a terrible idea. But yeah, the fact of the matter is that people who are using Ouija boards tend to sort of, they build themselves up to use it because that's what you want to do. You want to have a scary experience. So you put the candles up, you sort of gear yourself up to go into this mood. And people underestimate what hysteria can actually do.
Yeah.
People can die. People can literally lose, go crazy, like, and hurt themselves and hurt each other. And not necessarily be in control of themselves, because hysteria, the human mind, is an incredibly powerful thing, and it doesn't matter whether it's real or not, because the moment you decide it's real, it is real, and therefore, you know, you could be possessed.
Yeah.
And it could be entirely fictitious.
I mean, you get this massive amount of adrenaline dump, which suddenly makes you about 5 times stronger, because, you know, just briefly, and suppresses all sorts of other things and changes your perceptions. So, yeah. It's the whole fight or flight, or fright, actually, is the third option people don't think of, kicks in. I'm just trying to think, have I got any inexplicable experiences I can share? Because the starling thing was, like, totally easy to explain. It was actually a bird.
It was just a bird.
No, I've got quite a lot, actually, thinking about it. I'm just trying to think of a good one. This is back when I was a teenager. I was about 13, I think. We lived... it was a new housing estate, but it was out in the sticks. Actually, it was out in the village I wrote about in the second book, interestingly enough. And even my dad thought there was something a bit funny about that house. And back then, my dad was very sceptical about anything like that. And he said it didn't matter what the weather was like outside. The wind used to howl down the hallway. We had a massive, really, really thick velvet curtain that went over the doorway to try and keep the drafts out, and it still howled down there. And he said it didn't matter what you did, you couldn't keep a picture straight on the wall. So those were the things he noticed. The thing I noticed was going to sleep at night. And, you know, I was pretty, like, blasé about stuff. I didn't leave the light on, I had my door shut, I'd have the windows wide open to the night, I wouldn't bother drawing the curtains because I was out in the country and I just thought it was brilliant. And I remember being woken in the night by this icy cold finger trailing down my spine.
And your sister?
There is one really, really funny story about my other sister that I will tell you. It's something really horrible she did to me, which she's never let me live down. Anyway, no, this feeling of an icy cold finger going down my spine. And I rolled over finally because I couldn't shrug it off, because obviously I thought it was one of my sisters. It would be. And there was a dark shape standing over me, and I saw a flashing, huge, hungry white grin, and it was gone. And this happened several times over several different nights for months. And it was only when I realised that a friend in that area had had exactly the same experience, she lived in the same road, that I thought, perhaps I'm not imagining this. Or perhaps there's more to it than that. And the next time it happened, I turned it over and I screamed at it really angrily to just go away. And never came back. Now, how much of it is a product of my own mind, I don't know. But when we did a little bit of digging around in the area, we found out that the housing estate had been built on what was a graveyard at one point. But it wasn't a proper graveyard. It was where people were buried when they died unshriven. So they hadn't confessed their sins, or they were, you know, mothers who died in childbirth out of wedlock, or children who weren't baptized, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that was already, it already had this big build-up of being sort of a place where people didn't want to go anywhere near it. And I think sometimes land and other places, houses, aren't haunted by anything in particular, but they are haunted by expectation. And if enough people believe things, it's like a Tibetan prayer wheel. Yeah. And you can sort of create something that other people can pick up on.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. This has given me all sorts of ideas, but I feel that...
But what we did find was that there was a murderer there about 200 years before who used to use it as a dumping ground. For the women he caught and strangled.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. Oh, well, I suppose it was a bit, really. I always remember my grand saying, well, don't fear the dead. Dead can't hurt you, the living can. Which is perhaps a bit trite, and I've heard other people say it since, but she meant it quite literally. And this is the grandmother who told me about the banshee.
Yeah. We've never actually had any sort of tales of dead people killing living ones. I mean we have lots of stories of it, but we've had lots of accounts of hauntings and stuff like that and scary things happening. We've never had any accounts of, verifiable accounts of dead people actually killing living people.
No. Anyway, I'm
So.
going to round it off on something slightly funnier, and more embarrassing for me. When I was nine, I've always been irresistibly drawn to ghost stories, and as a child, I would read, really quite adult type ghost stories, and I'd get them out of the library, and my mother would be furious because she said, "You won't sleep," and I'd be like, "Yeah, of course I'll sleep. I'll be fine." She said, and I never did. I always had nightmares off of them. And I got Dracula. I didn't get the children's abridged version, which doesn't make any sense. I got the adult unabridged version, which, isn't really that scary, but it is when you're 9 years old. And because one of my grandmothers was staying over, so she had my room, so I was sleeping in with Sarah, who's only Sarah's only 13 months younger than me. And we had bunk beds. And I'd gone off to use the bathroom, and when I came back, she leapt off the top bunk in the dark, straight down on top of me, or rather in front of me, just in front of me, just came out of the dark. I have never screamed so loud in my entire life. And she'd slicked her hair back and thrown something around her shoulders to look like a cape as well. I mean, absolute cow. If you ever mention this, she will literally start crying with laughter because this is still the funniest thing ever now. So I think the takeaway point of this is my sisters are both evil.
That is really horrible.
I know, I got in so much trouble for yelling. She didn't get in trouble for leaping on me because I should have known better. I shouldn't be reading books like that. And I certainly shouldn't be making that much noise.
That's simply not fair.
That's like being the older sibling, unfortunately. And obviously, I'm laughing now. It's only taken, 10, 15, 20 years to get
To
over
get
it.
over it. Oh dear.
So,
Well,
anyway, sorry, I've wandered off topic a bit there at the end, but
no.
I still stand by my three things that you definitely need for a good ghost story to work if you're writing one, or what to look for if you're reading one.
And on that note, I feel that it is worth mentioning that Jules and I are actually going to be undertaking a project at
Oh,
some
yeah.
point. Yep, at some point we're going to be putting together an anthology of our own ghost stories. We will tell you a little bit more about that as and when it comes into fruition.
Yeah.
But so I feel all inspired now after this discussion
I
today.
mean, I've got so many more ghost stories I can tell you, but I'm just not gonna. I won't do it now. We'd be
Yeah,
here. We'd be here all week.
appreciate that. Yeah, well, let's wait until we're in my, house in Horsham in West Sussex, which is
In bright
apparently one of the
daylight.
most haunted counties ever. Apart from, I'm pretty sure Dorset is probably more haunted, but in the middle of Horsham in the Dragon Forest, with all the ghosts there, and we can get going. Yeah, I look forward to it. Well, I think that we should round it up then today.
Yeah, okay. So, we've talked a little bit about M.R. James and Edgar Allan Poe and Susan Hill, so the greats of ghost story writing, really. My personal favourite, which is The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters. We've looked at some ghostly films.
Yes, including and plays, including The Woman in Black, and the comparison between the film, the book, and the play. And we've also talked about The Ring, both briefly looking at the Japanese version and the Western version, and The Sixth Sense, and obviously the Blair Witch Project. And all in all, we've agreed we like ghost stories, and
We want them done properly. In fact,
Apparently, I'm affected more by them than you are, Joel.
I'm a ghost connoisseur, apparently. So, you know, anyone who's got any suggestions for really good ghost stories, send them my way. I'm interested.
And if you have any ghost stories or ghost experiences that you'd like to share with us, which maybe will wheedle their way into our anthology, do get in touch. And yeah, well, thanks very much for listening, guys. See you
thanks
guys next
and goodbye.
Week. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.